We continue the shiur in Shvuach Teheran, Rabbeinu Zal, the story of Rabbeinu Zal's journey to Eretz Yisrael. We were up to the part where Rabbeinu Zal had visited all the holy places in Tiberia, Tzfas, Midon. He'd visited the greatest tzaddikim there, especially Rabbi Avraham Kaliska Zal, whom Rabbeinu Zal classified as the greatest tzaddik in his time, the most complete tzaddik. Now, Rabbeinu Zal was ready to return home, and he sent his Talmud to go to Haifa, and there to make arrangements to go back. The Talmud came to Haifa. There he met someone who was bringing money to Eretz Yisrael, and through his intervention, the money safely arrived back in Tiberias. Then Rabbeinu Zal wanted to go to Yerushalayim. Again, this time he had serious intentions of going to Yerushalayim, and Rabbi Avraham Kaliska Zal dissuaded him. And that's how Rabbeinu Zal never got to Yerushalayim. A little later on, a plague broke out in Rabbeinu Zal's neighborhood in Tiberia. Rabbeinu Zal fled this plague. A plague meant, of course, the type of plague that wreaks havoc. It kills indiscriminately. In those days, these plagues could not be checked. Rabbeinu Zal fled the area of this plague. As the Gemara says, get out of that area because the angel of death runs rampant. Rabbeinu Zal moved from there quickly. He moved to a second neighborhood. Again, the plague followed, and so Rabbeinu Zal was forced to flee from the city of Tiberia. In fleeing at that time, they had already closed the gates of the city. There was no way out. So Rabbeinu Zal went through a tunnel which would lead to the wall around the city. And going through that tunnel, he came to the wall. He climbed on hands and feet over the edge of the wall, and suddenly, clinging desperately to the top of the wall, he found that beneath him there was only the sea. And those who were there would know that below that wall is the sea, meaning the Yom Kineris, and the rocks below. So the danger was so great that there was practically no chance of getting out alive. He would slip. It would mean imminent death. There was no way to get out physically. It was impossible. Rabbeinu Zal reports only that he raised his eyes to heaven, and that was it. He found himself later in the city of Tzfas. How was Rabbeinu Zal rescued? Was an angel sent down to rescue him? Was he plucked from the air and placed on dry land? This is not told. Rabbeinu Zal does speak about this point at length. And he speaks about this point as referring to every single Jew. This is not just the Tzadik Emes who has this miracle done to him. In fact, on the contrary, the Tzadik Emes would be the last person to have this miracle done to him. The Gemara says that the Tzadik, when he is in trouble himself, then he cannot help himself much. He could help others who are in dire circumstance, but not himself. The only solution was that he raised his eyes to heaven and gave himself over, threw himself upon the mercy of heaven. Rabbeinu Zal said that this advice, this step, is one that every Jew could take. If ever you find yourself surrounded by raging, stormy waters, you find that there is no hope whatsoever to be saved, then cast yourself upon the mercy of heaven and give yourself over completely with nothing, no hope of aid from elsewhere except directly from heaven. Even if you feel you're not deserving, you do not merit having a miracle done for you, still close your mind to everything, to your past, to your deeds, and turn your face upwards to heaven with just one word, Hashem, help me. It is fact, it is absolutely fact, that every person during his lifetime experiences a time, a moment, when he feels that there is no possible hope of being rescued. Something occurs during his lifetime, and at that time, he does turn desperately to Hashem, and he forgets later on that a miracle was done for him. But we do say this in the Shemoneh Esrei every day. We give thanks to Hashem. The miracles you perform for us every single day. The marvels and wonders and good that you do for us. These are done for us not just once a day, but evenings, mornings, afternoons. We have these miracles done, performed by Hashem for us. And it is only a question of acknowledging it. As the Gemara says, that the usual case is that a person who has a miracle done for him refuses to acknowledge this. What does he do? He implies, or he feels, he attributes it to an act of nature, to a normal act. And this is what's meant by a story we've had by Eliyahu Navi, when he had to go into a contest with the false prophets of the Baal to prove who was right. They were told to build a mizbeach, an altar, to their idol, and to place a sacrifice on this mizbeach without using any fire. They should pray to their idol, call upon their idol for miracle to bring fire. Then in turn, of course, that was in vain. In turn then, he took a mizbeach, he built a mizbeach of stones, a circular mizbeach, and he had water poured into that circular opening. Then he placed the sacrifice on that. Water cannot burn. Then he called out to Hashem. A miracle and a fire came down from heaven, consumed everything, the water, the stones, the carbon, everything. His tefillah was, Aneni Hashem Aneni. Answer me, Hashem, answer me. The Gemara asks, why did Eliyahu Navi say to Hashem twice, answer me? Why twice? Many different explanations for this. The Zohar Kodesh says that he said, answer me in my zechus, answer me in the zechus of my Talmud, Elisha Navi. But the actual, the factual words, as the Gemara says, were, Hashem, answer me and send a miracle. Send a miracle that fire should come from heaven, should consume everything. Secondly, Hashem, answer me that this miracle should not be wasted, that they should not attribute this to a normal act of nature, because people who refuse to accept, refuse to acknowledge Kedusha, refuse to acknowledge the existence of a heavenly power, no matter what you show them, they'll say this is nature. The greatest proof of this, as Nosenzel says, is the fact that creation itself. You imagine a creation that is so vast and so complex. You have the heavens, the earth, the solar system, the different planets, the stars, on this earth itself. So complex a type of creation with so many infinite types of beings. In human life, animal life, bird life, fish, insect life. You have insects that are microscopic, and yet that are that have so many parts to them, so many different types of seeming mechanism in their movement. All this, these infinite numbers, are created by Hashem at the time of creation and exist now. And what's more than that is the fact that they reproduce now. And yet there are people, despite all this, there are people who will look at these miracles and say, Chas v'Shalom, this is nature. How does this happen? It's normal act of nature. This is natural. They refuse to acknowledge the fact there is a supreme creator, a Bede Elam, who created this and who conducts everything that follows. This was the tefillah of Eliyahu Navi when he said the second word, Aneni, help me Hashem, that they should not be misled. They should not mislead themselves into saying this was an act of nature. They should recognize this as a miracle and thereby turn back to Hashem. This is what the Rabbeinu Zal said. He came to this point, the moment of facing possible death or facing certain death. He turned his eyes up to Hashem and davened to Hashem. At that was a quick moment. Davened to Hashem, and he just gave himself over to Hashem. And of course, Aben Ezel was rescued by Hashem. But Aben Ezel spoke of this many times afterwards, that this was an act of Hashem, a miracle which he acknowledged naturally, and which he proclaimed for all the world to know, that this will happen to you also. You will be the recipient of a miracle, whether you deserve it or not. At least deserve it afterwards by recognizing it and being thankful for it, being grateful for the miracle that comes to you. But when you say this Tefillah of Maidim, you say Yisach Hashem Chol Yoyimonu, thank Hashem for the Nisim, at least say it with emunah, with true faith, with feeling, with recognition. Aben Ezel came to the city of Tzfas, and while there, Aben Ezel and a student now heard that the French army was closing in. They had already captured, invaded Egypt. They'd gone through along the Mediterranean border, the western border of Israel, and following that border, they went up to the city of Jaffa. That's what today is the borders Tel Aviv. And he had already captured that city. Napoleon had captured the city of Jaffa, was going still further north towards the city of Akko. Akko was the city where they could get the boat going back to their land. When they heard this, Aben Ezel sent his Talmud to Akko quickly, there to hire the services or to purchase a place, a cabin, on a special ship. This was wartime. Of course, the waters were filled, the Mediterranean was filled with Turkish warships and French ships, and also English ships. The British had joined in this battle against Napoleon. They had joined the Turks. So the only ship that at that time they could travel with, other than the warships, was a ship called the Regaz. Regaz was a neutral type of ship. They would be like the Swiss, a Swiss type of ship called Regaz, which would not be harmed if any destroyer, any battleship would see a ship with the flag of Regaz, they would not attack it. Then I'll send this Talmud to buy passage on this ship of Regaz, and the Talmud came. He went to Akko, and there he bought places on the ship. And meanwhile, Aben Ezel prepared himself to leave the city of Tzfas and go to Akko too. The Avraham Kaliskazal sent him a letter. The letter was supposed to arrive. Aben Ezel could not wait. He refused to wait because he knew the emergency that existed. And so that was Thursday night. He traveled all night and all day, Friday, until 3 hours before Shabbos began, which would be approximately 20 hours trip, traveling at full speed from the city of Tzfas to the city of Akko. Most of you have been there to Israel, you know what that means. Going from Tzfas to Haifa, which means going along the north towards the western border. Akko is at the western border. And then you turn left, going southwards to the city of Haifa. From Akko to Haifa is approximately 30 minutes by car. And from Tzfas to Akko is approximately an hour or a little less by car. A little less than an hour by car or by bus. This trip took 20 hours going at full speed. Imagine then the type of traveling that was transpired in those days. He came to Akko at 3 hours before the time for Shabbos to begin. And of course, he hurried and wanted to board this ship. You board the ship before Shabbos begins, and you may safely stay there for Shabbos or even travel there. However, when they tried to board it, they were told that the ship was overfilled. There were more tickets sold than could take, the passengers could be put into the ship. So they were refused. They refused admission to the ship. They were forced to spend the Shabbos in the city of Akko. This was the Shabbos Parsha Zochar, Shabbos just before the holiday of Purim. They had letters from Adam Kaliskazal, which gave them openings to all the important people, leaders of the city. They spent the Shabbos in the home of a very rich man there, who took them in very happily for the schus of taking advantage of his home. And meanwhile, the city of Akko became filled with Turkish soldiers, Turkish army. There were over 15,000 Turkish soldiers that didn't belong there originally. 15,000 soldiers in that city of Akko. If you recall the size of the city, it caused such a compression, made it practically impossible to walk the streets anymore. And of course, this caused an outcry, and especially now when they locked the gates to the city, there was no way out. And the Turkish soldiers, remember the pasuk says, Yishmael's peda odom, Turks in general, are wild men. They are not normal in the mental sense. So they began to threaten that they would start to slaughter the people in the city as a simple expedient of making room. There was no room for the soldiers, they'll kill the people living there. This caused an outcry, and while this threat was going on, the ticket agent came to Rabbeinu Zal and said to Rabbeinu Zal that it is Shabbos now. I ask your permission to go out and buy you a ticket, because this is pikuach nefesh, it's a matter of life and death. Is it permissible to break the Shabbos, take money and buy a ticket on a different ship? Rabbeinu Zal consented. He went out and bought them tickets on a merchant ship, which means it would not take part in war normally. And at that moment, a whole fleet of ships came in from England into the harbor at Akko. This caused an additional pressure in the city. And so Rabbeinu Zal told his student, go out quickly, buy food for the journey, and then we'll go to our ship. The Talmud went out. He returned empty-handed because he said there's no food to be gotten anymore. The soldiers have taken over the city. And the Talmud, because of the fright and what he had seen in the city, came into the house, went into a different room, and there he fainted. He remained in a faint, unconscious. And at that moment, a few moments later, a loud order was proclaimed by the Pasha, that's the Turkish leader of the city, that he allows the civilians 2 hours' time to get out of the city. Out means only by water, not by land. The gate is closed. Anyone left after those 2 hours will be slaughtered. Rabbeinu Zal ran quickly to the sea, and he came to the port where the ships were. He boarded a ship, which he presumed was his ship. The Talmud awoke a short time later, and he didn't see the banners out there. He heard the voices screaming, crying, screams of terror. He went out into the yard, the street. The woman living there, a Jewish woman living there, apparently a tzaddikus. Note the kind of women that lived then. And in amazement, we see the nature of a pure tzaddikus. This woman turned to Rabbeinu Zal's Talmud, who was a stranger to her, and said to him, you're in grave danger, because there's going to be a massacre here. People are going to die at the swords of these wild soldiers, these Turks. Now, it's a pity on you. We, at least, she said, we live here. Well, we deserve it. We are Jews living in Eretz Yisrael, and we have had the pleasure, the zechus, of living here, then we can die here gladly. But you have left your family elsewhere, and you are younger yet. It's a pity that you should have to die, and therefore I advise you to flee. We will take it, you get out. It's your life we care about more. These are the words of a woman ready to die for the sake of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, and trying to help a stranger, a man. This is chivalry, helping a man get out, save a man's life. We cannot tell who she was, but she did help advising Rabbeinu Zal's Talmud to get out quickly. The fact that she told Rabbeinu Zal left already, otherwise he might have waited there additional time, he might have been killed. They tried to take the trunk in which they had the belongings. He couldn't move it because he was that weak from fright. And Hashem sent a servant, a porter, who was going about. Middle of this pandemonium, this porter came and said, I'm willing to take this trunk and carry it to the port for you. Find a porter during peacetime. Time like this, a porter appeared and said, I'll carry the trunk for you for a few cents. He carried his trunk over to the port. And there, he looked about frantically for Rabbeinu Zal. Finally, he saw Rabbeinu Zal sitting on board a ship. They were both overjoyed in being reunited. And he had this trunk brought aboard the ship. And there, they were taken aboard. The sailors on board showed them to a cabin. This was all done hurriedly. When they had a few moments of time, they looked about them, and they were surprised to see that this ship, merchant ship, was stocked fully with cannon. All along the sides of the ship, there were cannon. What kind of a merchant ship carries such cannon? They figured this must be special emergency measures during the wartime. They were there for a short while, and they suddenly realized that this was actually a warship. They could see no passengers whatsoever. These were all Turkish soldiers, a Turkish captain. These were all wild men who would not hesitate to kill them. So they tried to leave the ship, but it was too late because suddenly the cannon, the bombs started to fly overhead, and the war broke out in a tumultuous roar. So the ship pulled up anchor and left the port. They stayed in their bunk cabin, terrified, and they could not negotiate or speak with the Turks because they had no idea of their language. Suddenly a person opened the door, dressed in white, sort of a sheet, and spoke to them in Russian, their tongue. He told them, what are you doing here? You're on board a warship, you're in danger. So they said to him, please get us off. Speak to the captain to release us. This stranger disappeared. They thought he had spoken to the captain. Instead, they approached the captain later. The captain looked at them as though they were insane. As a show, he sent them back to their cabin, and they stayed there while the bombs and the shooting took place overhead. They realized that their lives were now more in danger than ever before. This was a point, this was a time just as Napoleon began to invade, began to attack, not invade, but attack, to besiege the city of Aku. Again, those who visited Eretz Yisrael, those who went on our trips there, I pointed out each time, each trip, that going by car from Haifa to Tzfas, or Tzfas to Haifa, you pass by the city of Aku. At the outskirts of Aku, about approximately a half mile outside of the city, you have a hill or a mountain. This is called the Mountain of Napoleon. This is where Napoleon built a man-made mountain and brought his heaviest artillery on top of that mountain, and used that to shoot his cannon into Aku, trying to break through the Aku defenses. Napoleon's army was the most powerful in the world at that time. It conquered practically most of the world. Napoleon, a great conqueror, and he besieged the city of Aku for 2 months. A continuous bombardment of 2 months. The result was a fiasco. He was forced to leave. He never got into the city of Aku. He couldn't, because the city of Aku, built with a wall around it, with a moat around it, was impregnable. And yet this story is told about how in 1948, the war between, the War of Liberation is called, Mohammed HaShichrur, when the Havdil, the Jews, fought against the Arabs and the British then, the British bastion, their fortress was in Aku. The Arabs had Aku as their main fortress, and the Jews conquered the city with the help, of course, with Hashem's help, of course, through the messenger Shlichim, were the Irgunis. Irgun, not the Haganah, who had the courage and the brains. So they were selected from heaven to be the ones to capture this city that Napoleon could not take in 2 months. This handful of men took in just a few hours. There's one additional item which we'll just mention in passing. We cannot speak about it at length because there is no conclusive proof. It's an item that I've heard about Peh orally. I've seen it in writing, but not in the writings of Nussensloh. Question about a possible meeting between Rabbeinu Zal and the Emperor Napoleon. There is a version that says that they met just before Rabbeinu Zal left the city of Aku, the outskirts of Aku. Napoleon, who was an emperor chosen from heaven, as the Gemara says, knew whom to turn to for advice. He spoke to Rabbeinu Zal asking the future. Will he be successful in this venture to conquer? Rabbeinu Zal advised him, gave him certain advice, which he rejected foolishly, and this causes downfall. Rabbeinu Zal says only that, as we know, the Gemara says in the Basra, we learned that any person, any human, who was appointed to a high position, whether it's the position of a president of an organization containing 10 people in it, or the president or the head, the chairman of a board, a large company, or politically he's appointed, he's voted in as mayor or governor or president or king. This position is given him only after it is decided in heaven. Heaven decides first who shall reign as king or president next, and then he gets this position. Now, when we say heaven decides, the heavenly court decides, this point the Gemara says, but who is the heavenly court? It does not say Hashem decides, it says the heavenly court, Pameya Shamala. And we find many times that Hashem turned to the heavenly court for them to decide. Who is this heavenly court that determines who wears the crown next? Benazal said that the heavenly court means the tzaddikim amitim, or a certain tzaddik at that time. This is not a tzaddik in heaven. This is a heavenly person. So at that time, Benazal spoke about one of his talmidim, whose name was Yisrael Isaac Zal, who was so sharp, so pure, so deep, and so holy a tzaddik, that his tefillos, his davening, would slice right through all the heavens and go directly to the Kisei HaKavod, the throne of Hashem. Rabbeinu Zal once said that he saw in heaven the effects of his students' tefillos. He stood there marveling and drawing nachas and seeing the koyach, the power of tefillah of the student. Rabbeinu Zal said that when they had to appoint this king, speaking about Napoleon, then too, he said, little did they know that this student of mine sitting there, who is absorbed in what he's doing now, study, Torah, not even paying attention to these words, is at this moment being asked in heaven, whom do you select as king? What is your preference? Whatever you say, that's the one. This is the koyach of the tzaddik emes. Of course, what would a tzaddik who was so absorbed in Avodas Hashem know about politics? How would he know whether to choose a certain person for president, Democrat, Republican, or the other type? And the answer, of course, is that we see them as Democrats, Republicans, as humans. A tzaddik sees much further than that. He sees the fate of that person. He sees the muzzle of that person, a malach, a guardian angel, and that's how he selects. So there are things that we cannot see at all, the tzaddik does see. And therefore, in this case, Napoleon's venture, we could say, was where there are so many volumes of history written about it, actually we know the power behind the throne. It was not Napoleon's wife. It was the decision, one that decided the steps of battle, decided the one that would take over the kingdom, was this one tzaddik emes on earth who had in his power the power of decision that could move continents and empires. Now again, we cannot confirm definitely the fact that Abinazal spoke to Napoleon. As he said, there is a definite version about this, and we just mentioned it in passing. Someday we'll know the truth. There's no question about it, though, that whatever happened to Napoleon, Abinazal had a hand in it, because he was the tzaddik emes then. The next morning, Abinazal and his student again planned to plead before the captain to let them out. However, they found themselves riding on the seas now with shots, cannon all around them. And the war became increased in intensity. The ship left port, and a high wind, a powerful wind, carried them far away from port. They found themselves without any bread or water whatsoever. One of the most important things on board a ship is water. You cannot drink the water that the ship travels on, seawater. The cook found favor in the eyes of the cook. He brought them a cup of black coffee twice a day, morning and evening, and this sustained them. Meanwhile, a very heavy storm broke out. They reached a different port, and they were notified that this is the port of Adel, near Turkey, and that this city, Adel, was a place where it was famous the fact that they would slaughter any Jew who came to this city. Because of this, they hid in their cabin, the stateroom, for a period of 3 days successively. 3 days because they knew if they would show themselves, their lives would be forfeit. Suddenly, the anchor was torn out of its mooring, and the boat took off like a bullet. The sailors were filled with fright, too, and there was no controlling the ship now because of the stormy winds. And a day later, they found themselves close to the port of Aku again. They'd been carried backwards. Again, the storm broke out, and this time the boat began to fill with water. They were now filled with a real panic. The sailors on board, the Turks, Mahavdil, Abinazal, and his Talmud now saw that their lives were again in a type of danger from which there is no escape. Because if the boat is filled with water, the boat would sink. There's no way out. It'd be swallowed by sharks to drown. You can't pull over to the side and take a cab from there. So they saw that their lives were really in danger, and they noticed that Abinadal stayed in the cabin. He sent his Talmud out to see how things are going along. The Talmud saw that they had gotten rid of all their excess baggage. Everything was thrown overboard, and still the boat was in danger of sinking because the boat now carried so much water, more than the amount of baggage it could carry. The sailors continued to pump water out of the boat, but they couldn't pump as fast as water came in. Obviously, there was a hole. The boat had been punctured, the ship, and water was coming in too quickly. Now, this was one danger. He came back to the Abinazal and reported this. His face was white, he was frightened, and he said, "There's no hope at all for us." The Abinazal said to the student, "For a strange reason," he said, "put your coat on, gird yourself, as though you're ready to go on a trip, and take your money belt around you, your staff in hand, and ready to go." So the Abinazal's Talmud asked, "Why do we have to have our money on us? There's a difference whether the fish swallow you with money or without money." Then it also said, "Do not ask any questions, because the Jews were in greater danger at times, and they were saved. So do as I say." It came the question of davening. The Talmud said that he was in such a panicky state of mind, he couldn't think. Concentrate on davening. Then it also said, "Well, then just say Kriya Shema and the first three and last three brachas of the Shemoneh Esrei, and that's enough. So the Talmud said to the Rabbeinu Zal, I am very small, but you are so great, why don't you daven and just pluck us out of the sea? Tzaddik like you could perform miracles. Rabbeinu Zal said, because now I am the Melech and the Katnas. When a tzaddik is in trouble, then it is as though he is imprisoned. He is bound. He cannot move himself. When he is free, he can move mountains, worlds, to free others. But when he himself is imprisoned, then ein chovish mati desatzmai. You recall in the Gemara many times that a tzaddik in prison cannot release himself. He must have others to assist him. So Rabbeinu Zal said, I'm going to do something which I have not done before. I'm going to use Zechus Ovis. I'm going to ask Hashem to help us in the Zechus of my illustrious chain, family tree. He was in Spalla and said, Hashem, help me in the Zechus of my ancestor, the Baal Shem Tov, the Zechus of Adil, Baal Shem Tov's daughter, the Zechus of my grandfather, Nachman Haridenke. That's all that Rabbeinu Zal mentioned. And then they were now in danger of drowning. To add to this now, they looked and saw that the boat was traveling at an unusual speed. It was being drawn towards what they could see was a cloud coming down. It looked like a water spout. The cloud hovers over the water and then draws up like a whirlpool of water, a water spout from the sea itself. And this causes such a powerful draw. Anything around is drawn into this spout, and it sinks immediately. No matter how large it could be, the biggest ocean liner would be drawn into the water because of the power of the spout. The way to break this spout is usually by shooting cannon at it to break this train of clouds. There was no time to do that now, to even attempt it, and the boat was drawn towards it, and they felt that this was really the end. Boat about to sink with water in it, now the water spout, and traveling at such speed towards it, they felt this was definitely the end. The Rabbeinu Zal's tefillah, when he said this, suddenly drew the boat towards the cloud. In the cloud there was an opening, and it went right through this opening, the cloud, out the other way into clear sunlight. And on top of that, immediately they found suddenly the source of this opening where the water was coming in, a leak. They slaughtered a goat, took the hide of that goat, and sealed the hole, and everything turned to simcha instead of the sadness. They were now saved, rescued from the danger of drowning. They went through safely, and because of this, they celebrated by giving Rabbeinu Zal and his Talmud also some rotten vegetables, which was the first thing they had to eat in a long time. This was close to Pesach now. They were very worried about what would happen on Pesach. What was going to be then, because it meant that they would have to fast the entire week. They couldn't touch any of the regular food, even vegetables, from this on this or this ship or the coffee. It was surely chametz. They couldn't get matzah or wine. They would have to literally fast the entire 8 days, and that would be impossible, practically impossible. They were very worried about it, and they hoped at least that they could get any kind of fruit, clean fruit, to eat on Pesach. They practically gave up the hope of getting matzah and wine on Pesach. A short time later, they reached a city that was located on a mountainous island in the middle of the sea. And there, these sailors went out and bought buksa. These buksa that we eat on Chmishos of the Shvat. And this they bought for the Rabbeinu Zal and his Talmud too. And now they were happy to have at least some food for Pesach. But they said, now we can really inspire a hope that we'll be able to be zechah to get matzah and wine through some miracle. Now, at this time, though, we have to understand again Rabbeinu Zal's actions in that tefillah, desperate tefillah. They found themselves close to death. The ship was doomed, apparently. It was going to sink. It was going to be destroyed. They would all die. Rabbeinu Zal, in desperation, was now mispowel Hashem, the schus of my forefathers, the Hashem Tev, Odl, Nachri Dekezal, help me in their schus. What is meant by this kind of tefillah? And what is meant by a tzaddik not being able to help himself. Tzaddik is so great, since a tzaddik is so great, that he could visit heaven at will. We find stories of Baal Shem Tov, Benazal too, where so many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of neshamas, souls from the other world, came to Rabbein Azal pleading with him to help them. And it's much harder to help a soul than it is to help a living person on earth, except for the Bechira. The choice, of course, is harder. A dead person, a soul, no longer has free choice. He knows what he wants. A person on earth, to persuade him to do mitzvahs is much more difficult. He can be very stubborn if he wants to and refuse. But still, to help a person physically on earth is much more simple than helping a soul. Since a tzaddik is that great, he can help thousands, tens of thousands of souls, and he is that great, they know where they come, they know the address where to go to. This is the tzaddik emes. He has his power over these souls in heaven, and over the angels in heaven, which means over forces that are far greater than this entire universe. Why should it be so difficult to perform a simple act? Pick up this little ship. What is a tiny ship compared to a heaven? Pick it up, transport it over to a safe place, remove the water from the ship by simply saying one word. If Lahavdil, a magician, can perform magic, then certainly a tzaddik too could perform miracles. Greater miracles than any magic that exists. Why is it so difficult? And of course, too, if a tzaddik could perform miracles in heaven by moving himself to the heavenly realm, which no person, the strongest person, cannot do, move at such speed, to move from here to the heavens, and there to wander freely among the different sections of heaven, among the vast angelic powers that exist, then on earth, it's literally nothing. Comparison. This is the question that the Zohar Kodesh asks, actually. The Zohar Kodesh replies, answers this question very sharply. It says that the tzaddik, one who studies Torah, this is all included in the Vav of Hashem's name. The Vav stands for Torah. The Vav is Zeirampin. That's the Luchais, the tablets, the Torah, Torah Gdesha. This is all the life of a tzaddik. Tzaddik is dedicated to the study of Torah. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu, for example, was symbolized by the Vav of Hashem's name. Zeirampin. Yaakov Avinu too. In this case then, the Zohar Kodesh says the Vav is the tree. Which tree is that? The Eitz HaChayim, the tree of life. We say the Torah is Eitz HaChayim Hilo Machzikim Bo. The Torah is the tree of life, and this tree of life is what the tzaddikim are attached to. The tzaddik is the symbol of the tree of life, the Torah, and he himself is attached to this tree of life. This Eitz HaChayim B'Soch HaGan, this tree of life is in Gan Eden. The source is in Gan Eden. The power of a tzaddik emes is in Gan Eden, heavenly. But he is divorced from the powers on earth. He does not use those powers for earthly reasons. And therefore, we could see why many times, for that reason alone, there is a rasha, wicked person, an evil person that has no power of kedusha, and yet he has more influence on earth than the biggest tzaddik. He has more wealth, more power, more ease, more influence. The biggest tzaddik suffers, has nothing in comparison. And the reason is because the tzaddik has this tree of life and adheres to this tree of life alone. He will use that there. In heaven, he has a lot of influence. He can take all these neshamas, these souls, who on earth had all these powers. They come there, they are doomed, they are destined to go to Gehenna, and those neshamas he can save, he can rescue. Because there is where his main powers lie. This is the koyach of the tzaddik emes. And again, the tzaddik emes at will could force the issue. He could say, I want to use some of these powers for the sake of doing something on earth, but the tzaddik emes will never be matriach. He will never be a burden to Hashem. He will always consider himself unworthy of doing something on earth. This is the reason why the Ben Azal turned to assistance from his forefathers, his ancestors, though he may have been much greater than them, because he would not use his own schusim for the sake of assistance on earth. And therefore, we too, when we speak about Tfilas Hashem, we ask in the schus of our forefathers, the schus of these great tzaddikim of the past, who in whose zechus we exist today, that in their schus we should be helped. We can be helped only if we have this infinite emunah, faith in the greatness of this tzaddikim. And that is what the main lesson of the story, to know that our hiskashus to the tzaddik should be that much stronger.